Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Hop Ons podcast. Hi, John.
Hey, man. It's so weird because we just talk right before you hit record.
I know.
And now you act like I just saw you for the first time today.
You just walked in the door.
I have to act a little bit. Hey, Colin.
You just walked
in the door. I'm so glad you walked in just now.
No, you walked into your own apartment. I was already here.
Oh.
That's how that works.
This is getting real weird, everybody. I know.
So in today's episode, we are talking about season one, episode three, Bringing Up Buster.
Yeah.
You were disappointed there was no Buster in episode two.
Yes, and now we have heaps and loads of Buster.
We have a copious amount of Buster in this episode.
A lot of Buster happening.
So, a bit of information. This episode aired on November 16th, 2003. Same day, same time slot. So, we're still on Sundays. We're still at 9:30.
Right.
5.78 million viewers.
So, we've lost about a million.
About a million. Yeah. We're down from almost nine from the pilot to under six.
Oh wow, that sucks.
It's losing viewership.
Yeah.
A bit of context, as always. Oh goodness me, those CSIs. CSI Crime Scene Investigation, which was a repeat on CBS, 15 million viewers.
Holy shit.
Law and Order Criminal Intent on NBC, 12.5 million.
I mean, I understand that.
The American Music Awards on ABC, 12.8 million.
Okay.
Right?
I mean, award shows are going to bring that in, yeah.
Indeed. On Fox, specifically, earlier that evening, The Simpsons around 12.5, and right before episode three, Malcolm in the Middle, 9.2. So Malcolm in the Middle is sitting strong at 9 million.
But that's such a crazy jump. I wonder why people are immediately changing the channel after Malcolm in the Middle's over.
I don't know.
Like, what could be on at 9:30? Well, I mean, people like that crazy about CSI.
I guess so. The second half of CSI.
Yeah, that's the thing. The last half of one of those shows.
I don't know either. Because no Alias on that evening. So Alias, I don't understand what they're doing with Alias, by the way. But no Alias, because I think Alias was on ABC.
ABC, yeah.
And so Alias was bumped because of the American Music Awards.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly. And the IMDb summary, which, Not incorrect, but again, oversimplified. A reluctant Michael takes Buster under his wing while attempting to get closer to an increasingly distant George Michael.
I guess kind of, but I wouldn't say that George Michael's increasingly distant. He does one thing.
I know. I think the episode wants us to think that there's a gap developing between Michael and George Michael.
A very dramatic plot summary.
I thought so, too. So this episode continues the theme of parenting and parental methods.
Right. Pretty hardcore. Indeed. The whole thing is really about it.
I know.
It is an absolutely insane episode, I will say, as most of them are.
Define your terms. What's insane about this episode?
The very first thing I have in my note is the insaneness of the cornballer. That's the very first note I have. That we see an old infomercial with George Sr. and Richard Simmons, of all fucking people, Richard Simmons. Then we immediately cut from that to Michael making cornballs and burning his hand. So it's like, that's like how we start this very dramatic plot summary of from the IMDb with an infomercial for a cornballer.
Right. And this is interesting because this is now the second piece of Bluth mythology. The first is the banana stand, and a lot of it is about food for some reason.
Yeah, that's weird.
The internal logic of the Bluth family seems to gravitate and build around food. We'll get the Skip Scramble at some point in season two.
We will. I forgot about that.
Which pops up a couple of times. My favorite thing from that whole infomercial exchange is the Richard Simmons, "Look what you did."
My favorite is when they play it, they do it in Spanish, and they dub him over, and they go, and George Sr. says, "Soy loco, post los cornballs." That's amazing. That's my favorite part.
So do you think, let's pause for a moment, because I want to talk about George Sr. as a businessman. Do you think this is designed to show us how much of an entrepreneur he is, or just how bad he is?
Oh wow, both. What's weird is right now, because of like, you know, the political climate, it's reminding me of Trump. Like this, I feel like this is something that Donald Trump would totally do. But yeah, that's what it reminds me of. Maybe he thinks he can get on the ground floor of some amazing design and he does this shitty infomercial for it. And then it just, you know, ends up setting things on fire, really, more or less. Because from what I gathered, like, it's not allowed to be sold anywhere. No. Right? It just is like, it's just banned from everywhere.
It's so illegal.
And it's just awesome because, like, and we see that's what one of my favorite gags in this is, everybody burns themselves on their cornballer. I mean, Michael and Tobias doing is very, very funny.
It is. Michael twice. We'll get to the second one. First one, and shortly after, one of my favorite lines, that stupid cornballing piece of shit.
Yeah, they bleep it. It's awesome.
Oh, okay, so can we talk about the bleeps as well? Because we get a bit of that in the pilot, but this is the first time where the bleeping becomes an important part of this show, and it's something that is abandoned in season 4 because it's a Netflix show. But do you like the bleeping?
Because I've
always thought this is really what makes the swearing funny, is that we don't actually hear it.
Right, and actually I write that in my notes because we don't really hear what Michael says before he says this piece of shit line. He says something else
right
as he's going to the fridge, but then later in the episode Buster has this fucking ridiculous rant, two of them, and you have no idea what he said.
No.
And if that was not bleeped, there's no way it'd be that funny. There's just no way. So yeah, I think the bleeping totally adds.
And anytime Job talks about his sexual conquests, he's always moving something in front of his face, which is hilarious. So there's a recurring gag in the first season where Job will say something like, "I fucked this person," but They always have Will Arnett positioned right in front of the camera, so he needs to bring something up to his face. It's usually a glass of whiskey.
Yeah.
But I love how they work around the swearing while still keeping it in. It's so clever. It's so interesting.
And this is a time in censorship when you can't even see people say the words.
Right.
Now you can. That's not an issue. But that also adds to the comedy of this.
I think
because
so.
All you do is see reactions of people, and it's very, very funny.
It is. Yeah. It is. No, you're absolutely right. They must work around even mouthing a word like shit or fuck.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or you're right, whatever that panoply Buster offers on two separate occasions. We meet Steve Holt in this episode.
Right, yeah. But before we get to Steve Holt, let's just go back and talk about everything that happens in the beginning and the cornball scene, because it's fantastic. I wrote down Lindsay's outfit and how fucking ridiculous it was. It's like a crop top sweater that has one strap, and she's wearing like long elbow gloves that are fingerless.
I love
and she's
song.
Not doing anything. That's all she's doing. And when I watched it, I was like, what the fuck is Lindsay wearing? Why does she have this on?
It seems like another one of those moments where they don't know what to do with Portia de Rossi, so they're just parading her around.
Yeah, that could be it. Yeah.
I don't want to think of it that way, I forgot to mention, still written by Mitch Hurwitz. So
oh, cool.
And also directed by one of the Russos.
The Russos.
Joe Russo, I forgot about that. Co-written by Richard Rosenstock.
No idea.
Dick Rosenstock. He's quite
it's
a great writer.
Name though. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't like to think that Mitch Hurwitz just doesn't know what to do with really the only female character in the show, but it feels a bit like she's getting paraded around.
Maybe if we were shown more backstory that she's always been this fashionista kind of, I don't know, because like it really caught me off guard. I mean, there's so much insanity happening in that scene that for me to actually pause and go, oh, why are you wearing this? Like, that's a big deal, because Tobias is going through his whole spiel of being a parent and George Michael pulling away from Michael. And one of my favorite lines is when Tobias says, if I could stick my pretty little nose in here for 1 minute. It's just,
later in the episode. So all Lindsay really does in this episode is talk about clothing. So she has a conversation later in the episode with Lucille where she's asking for money. And then there's the red dress, which returns later because Steve Holt's wearing it.
Steve Holt.
And Which, and we'll get to some of Tobias's aesthetic choices for the play he directs. It's completely insane. But all Lindsay seems to do is talk about clothing. Yeah. And later, I don't know if it's next episode or episode 5, we learn that she's always been celebrated for her appearance.
Yes.
So I maybe we could argue they're building toward that, mm-hmm. and the anxiety she has about not being recognized and acknowledged for her physical appearance when she goes to the prison.
Yeah.
But
which is great. Yeah.
It's God. It's so funny that slut t-shirt is. But I think just taken in isolation, it's really problematic how little Lindsay does.
Yeah. I mean, unless they're trying to make like a parody of that kind of person,
maybe
like, that's the only thing I could see. I think you're right. I mean, it's just, if that's her gag is look at how goofy I look, because I don't think I've ever noticed it until today. And I was like, why? I mean, you're in a house. Why aren't you like in sweats? You know, like, I mean,
and everyone else is in a robe, by the way.
Yeah. Yeah. Except
both Job and Tobias. Yeah. Michael has already, well, Michael and that shirt George Michael's wearing. We need to at some point.
Oh, yeah. It's awful.
At some point, I want someone to create some kind of a Prezi presentation of all the George Michael shirts, because his shirts are bonkers.
They are
insane. But yeah, everyone else is in a robe, but Lindsay, she's not, and I don't know what they're trying to do with that.
Yeah, I don't either. I wrote that down. I also wrote down, so Lindsay also, besides talking about clothing the whole time, also is trying to give Michael advice on his child.
Parenting advice, that's right.
Yeah, George Michael's pulling away from you. And Tobias says the same thing, and these two people have no idea what they're talking about. And Tobias even says, maybe he's like across the way in the living room. And Tobias says, maybe, what are you doing today? And he looks at Michael and goes, she won't tell me. And then she like says, oh, I'm auditioning for a play. And then Tobias, who's been burnt by the cornballer, this is one of my favorite lines, says, she's reaching out to her actor daddy. And then he goes, does anyone have an ice pack? That's like how that whole scene basically cuts.
So that whole scene, there's a lot of close-ups in this episode. Did you notice this?
I did,
and
yeah.
The way the camera moves toward Tobias's face at that moment, and he's doing this weird thing with his mouth and his tongue that seems to imply, oh my God, I have an idea. Something's percolating.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Wait, what is that searing pain on my elbow? I love the way close-ups are used in this episode in particular, because in the last episode, everyone felt really distant. I think you've spent a lot of time talking about mise-en-scene. There's a lot of wider shots in episode 2, but in this episode, everything feels really tight and really close and really intimate. But here's something interesting, though. You and I have watched every episode of Arrested Development probably at least 2 times. Mm-hmm. We know that throughout the trajectory of seasons 1, 2, and 3, it is in some ways a story about George Michael distancing himself from his father. So Lindsay's not technically wrong.
Right.
She's just accidentally correct.
That's a great way to put it.
Yeah. Because that's totally what's happening, and not all of season 1, but a lot of seasons 1 and 2 are about Michael trying to reconcile not having his son as his little boy any longer.
Sure.
And George Michael becoming a teenager and ultimately an adult in season 4. That's really interesting that Lindsay's technically correct.
She's an idiot.
But she is a beautiful idiot, though.
So from the cornball scene, we get Maybe is trying out for a play at high school because she wants to kiss Steve Holt, the main man,
who has braces in this episode, but he doesn't have braces in any other episode.
I don't think I think I noticed the braces here, but I didn't really remember that.
I don't think he has. Okay, so that whole sequence is amazing because everything comes in threes. So we see 3 auditions, and then we see 3 reactions to the casting. And I love jokes that come in threes.
Yeah,
and
it's
Arrested
awesome.
Development does that so beautifully. It's so funny.
Do you think that and Steve Holt is one of those characters that, like, he's originally portrayed as like the dumb jock,
right?
But I think he's like a very like lovely kind of guy. I think he's like got a good heart, and
he is, but that doesn't mean he's not the dumb jock.
He's definitely
because,
the dumb jock.
Because later we learn that I think it's a series of yearbook photos in either season one or two.
And the
very last one, he looks so depressed and demoralized because he can't graduate because he's so dumb. But no, I they do a lot of interesting things with Steve Holt, but I love his enthusiasm.
I do too.
Because you would think for someone who is just great at football, he couldn't care less about theater, but he's auditioning for a reason. And I think he's a really happy, bubbly, enthusiastic guy.
Yeah, he is.
And anytime Tobias makes a change, Steve Holt's reaction is, yeah, let's do it. At one point, he just yells, Beatrice.
Beatrice. Yeah, because
he embraces the cross-dressing aspect of the play in ways that I would suspect a 17, 16-year-old football player to not, because we see when Tobias introduces the idea, two or three of the boys just dash out of the auditorium.
Yeah.
But Steve Holt's very, okay, yeah, let's do this. Give me a dress. I love that about him. He's so accepting.
And Tobias introduces this idea because he thinks George Michael is gay.
That's correct.
And he wants to kiss Steve Holt.
So...
Okay. So Tobias is directing the play.
Yes.
And he does this in a great scene. He goes to the principal of the school and he says, please give me this opportunity to direct. He like comes up with this very Shakespearean way to ask.
Which doesn't make a lick of sense, by the
way. No, it doesn't.
If you actually define all of those words.
Yeah.
It doesn't make a lick of sense.
And it's a great line when the coach, like the gym coach, is like a table behind them eating. And the principal's like, are you okay with it? And he goes, let the little fruit have it.
And then Tobias's reaction is huzzah.
Yeah.
Tobias has a great line in that scene, by the way. That just makes me want to puke all over your face, sir.
Oh,
which I'm convinced is not in the script. This is another one of those David Cross. I think that's a line David Cross created. He basically, Joe Russo just said, David, just say a bunch of nonsense to him and let's see if he'll break. And that's one that was kept in.
I agree with that.
That's what I think. But so a couple of things. First, the let the little fruit have it.
Yeah. Rough.
Maybe coming from a coach, I don't mean to say anything disparaging about coaches, but maybe, and then later in the episode, maybe says something like, my dad thinks everyone is gay. And so this episode seems to be really sending that message that Tobias is closeted. And
oh, I still don't think so.
Really?
Yeah. Oh,
John.
Colin did the look away like he was going to punch me.
I was looking at that camera again. Like, can you believe this guy? So you don't think this episode hit that?
I mean, let's just talk about like the stereotypical coach.
Okay.
Any person that wants to direct a play and were to ask in that manner, he's going to call gay. Like the stereotypical.
Sure.
Very. And the whole maybe thing, again, that could be them taking the running gay joke a little too far, but I don't think that they're trying to shove that in your face that he's gay. I don't think that at all.
Okay. I'm not suggesting they're trying to put it right in front of our faces, I suppose, because we talked about with the pilot, a lot of the jokes still, and it's amazing that they still work, but a lot of the jokes, almost all the jokes still work. But mm-hmm. I introduced this idea that I wanted us to talk about whether or not the Tobias is gay humor still works.
Right.
And that's one of those scenes where I think we're led to laugh at that line, let the little fruit have it. I really feel like that was a punchline to that scene. That's what I mean. I wonder if there's something problematic about having that as the punchline.
Yeah, I don't know. And I don't think that. And again, I don't. When the coach delivers that line, I don't think it's got any kind of ill will in it. I mean, the word itself kind of does, but he doesn't say it in like a tone as if this guy is, you know, super homosexual or something. He's like reading a paper and like could care less about what's happening.
Sure.
And he says, let the little fruit have it. I don't necessarily.
But he cares enough to call him a fruit. He cares enough to.
What else could you? I guess
the guy have it.
I guess if we are trying to punchline the scene, then we have to have a line there.
Yeah. But I.
Does that idea of Tobias being closeted gay, is that offensive to you?
No. The idea that there's a character that's closeted is not a problem. The problem seems to be a lot of the humor is about, isn't it funny that he's closeted, or isn't it funny that he doesn't know, or isn't it funny that other people acknowledge it and they make fun of him for it?
Yeah, I think
that there are times that it feels like the show dips into that territory, and that might be problematic. Again, there's nothing inherently funny about a closeted person.
Right.
I think the show wants us to think there is something funny about that. At times. This is one of the few times where I think maybe the show is a bit insensitive and a bit retrograde. But I'm willing to forgive it. And that's okay.
Yeah. I guess the whole Navy line I didn't even think twice about. Yeah. But I've seen it so much that it's probably just.
Well, I'm not trying to suggest that of the two, the Navy line is completely innocuous and it's not problematic at all. Because maybe seems to be speaking from a position of experience, which I think is significant. But this coach, he's seen this person for 2 or 3 minutes and he just decides, well, he's a queer. And that's the tone, by the way. I just want to be clear. That seems to be the tone he's aping at that moment. Can you believe this gay guy wants to do this? Well, who cares? And I'll say something disparaging to him. And he won't even acknowledge it.
Yeah, and I think that, I mean, I understand what you're saying. But again, I do think they are just trying to stereotype the coach.
Sure. That's fair. So,
that's like it completely.
Yeah, and again, it begs the question, to whom is the joke directed? And sure. I think you could argue that it's maybe directed at both of them, because the coach certainly doesn't look good at that moment.
Yeah, I mean, there are ways to get by, because the rest of them is not PC at all.
No, it's not.
It doesn't try to be, and I think you could probably end that scene with just Tobias doing his crazy rant.
Right.
And then the principal is giving it to him.
Right.
And nothing's lost or gained. Really. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. I completely agree. Well, let's.
Well, that we went everywhere right there. Sorry, guys.
No. Let's not apologize. That's something I really want to talk about. Because one of the things we're trying to suggest is that this show still works. But that doesn't mean everything about the show works.
Sure.
And it's worth thinking about and talking about what doesn't work about this show.
Yeah.
12, 13 years later. But this episode is called Bringing Up Buster. And that's because Buster is back.
Yeah, he's so great. Let's talk about Buster. The Buster-Lucille love relationship.
it's given a little room to develop. And
it is. It starts with him zipping her up. That's like the very first thing we see is Buster zipping up his mom. Again, I think Buster is a straight mama's boy. We learn that a lot in this, that he is. George Sr. says, I had no time to raise him. I was just kind of over it. George Sr. says those words. So Buster is a very much mama's boy from day one.
He turned out a little soft, a little doughy,
which is a great scene. We'll talk about that scene because I love that scene.
There are two of those where the camera pulls back to reveal that Buster's sitting in the room the whole time.
It's so good.
So Buster, I remember you and I would laugh about this line, Lucille's line about cornholing.
Oh my God,
everyone's laughing and writing and cornholing except for Buster. That's.
She says, I wrote that down too because it's hilarious. What are they? They're going on bike rides making cornholes.
And the look on her face, Jessica Walters has this ability to look so vitriolic.
Yes.
It's amazing because she is completely unaware how silly the words are that come out of her mouth, but she's
super serious.
So this is a question that I had after watching the episode. If she loves Buster so much and needs Buster so much, why does she push him away toward Michael? Why do you think because this is something that seems to happen repeatedly in the show. Lucille pushes Buster away and then she desperately tries to pull him back.
Well, I think in this context of it, we see that Buster has been home a lot longer than he's supposed to be.
Right.
And Lucille's at her wit's end. So at that moment, she shoves him off onto Michael only to realize, like, the way that Buster realizes that she misses him.
Yeah.
And he misses her, even though he, like, goes through this whole weird arc of kind of, like, getting away from his mom, not liking his mom, talking bad about his mom, and then loving his mom again. Right. Like, all in a 30-minute span.
Right. Well, that trajectory mirrors Michael and George Michaels. And at the end, it's paid off because they have that moment in the kitchen with the cornballer, yeah, which yeah. is really nice. And I'm upset because you didn't say anything about my Al Pacino Godfather 3 hands when I did the you can't see this, listeners, but I went,
I don't know what you're talking about. What movie is that?
I
Godfather what? I know there's a 2. I don't remember a 3 ever.
I think it's the third one.
I don't remember a 3 being made.
I, you know, with Sofia Coppola?
I don't think that's a movie that exists, really? It's, Colin.
I'm
pretty sure that was never made.
There's a great Simpsons joke about that. I want to say Bart and Milhouse, they break into maybe Mr. Burns' private office, and he has all, and these are VHS tapes, yeah. by the way, which is hilarious, but he's reading through the titles, and one of them is Godfather 3, the good version.
Which is what? No Sofia Coppola?
It's not her fault.
We could talk a long time about the Godfather Part 3.
Let's come back to Arrested Development. We need to talk about Tony Hale's mannerisms and facial gestures. He is a fucking genius.
Yes.
There is this moment when they're in the copy room. And by the way, Job is putting toast or bread through the copy machine.
Through the shredder.
Oh, it's the shredder. Yeah. That's right. I'm so sorry.
Michael walks in and Job is just sitting on the shredder in a kimono.
You're right. Yeah.
And he's just shoving bread into the shredder.
So there's an exchange, and Job says, "What's he doing here?" And Buster says something to the effect of, "To spend time with Michael." And then he gives this smile, and I swear to God, I wish I would have marked the time so I could tell you, but you have to go back and see this smile. It's kind of like this. He goes, again, can't see that at all, but it's the most amazing look.
I know what you're talking about.
He's doing this thing with his arms because this is an awesome choice Tony Hale makes, where his arms are always really close to his chest. And his hands are near his neck and his shoulder as if to physically signify the discomfort he feels
yeah.
almost every moment of his life. It's such.
Well, I noticed this today when the George Sr. scene, they're talking. Buster reaches over and grabs Michael's arm really lovingly.
No, he doesn't.
Yeah, he does. He's like looking in his eyes and he grabs his arm, and it made me laugh so much.
Oh my God. That's so.
That's a perfect Buster thing.
It is. Just the things he does with his hands when Job, and this is, again, Will Arnett, his eyebrow work in that scene is hilarious because he asks Michael if he can stay, and Michael says, "No, you need to leave." And he says something to the effect of, "If this is business, I'll leave and I won't be angry. But if it's personal, then I will be angry." And he's doing all this weird eyebrow work, yes. which is amazing. And his hands are on his hips. And Michael, of course, could easily say, "No, it's business." But he, of course, says it's personal. And then he leaves the copy room. And Buster goes to like caress his shoulders. And it's just, God, it's such a weird but amazing little Buster moment. Buster looks
very offended, too. He's like, yeah. And he's like, starts rubbing one of his shoulders. It's so great.
Well, this is why I think Buster is ultimately a caretaker. I think Buster would be great if he was just caring for other people, because he seems to
sure.
want to soothe everyone. He wants everyone's life to be as comfortable as possible. And I think maybe it's because he feels so uncomfortable all the time. Buster's such a lovely character.
He is. Yeah. I think, I don't know what my favorite Buster moment is. There's a lot. The very first time we see Buster, when Lucille is kind of like at her wit's end with him, there's a bird in their house and he's chasing it. And he's like very, very childlike. And he's like, "There's a bird in the house." And she's like, "I know." And he goes, "It walked on my pillow."
But Lucille's line is so weird. She says, "I know there's a bird. I'm on the phone." And
that's so funny.
That's so strange.
She walked on my pillow.
He's taking a broom and just hitting the chandelier.
Yes, yes.
It's, oh God. It's,
oh
so,
my God.
It's so weird.
God, that's so fucking funny.
I know. So Michael, what are some of the things that Michael does with Buster, with his Buster's Day Out?
He gives Buster a bike to build.
Right.
And he decides to build. Well, we see Michael giving a speech to the board members of the Bluth Company, And we keep hearing these noises. And at that point, Michael says, and the camera again shows us what we need to see. And the camera does this like quick zoom. And he goes, and Buster, you can't do that in the snack room, pal. And Buster's got grease all over his face. And he looks at him dead eyed. He's like, Mom said not to get in her microwave.
And that's a callback to the pilots, where Buster's in the and doesn't he say something to the effect of, this will be the most bitchin' bike ever?
Yeah, this is going to be the most bitchingly awesome bike in all of the. He says OC, right?
I think so.
And Michael says, don't call it that or something like that. And then we show them exercising at the house, like doing like their butterfly stretches and stuff. And that's when Buster just kind of lets go with all of his because. Because Michael says, you're going to be eating my dust all day. And then it's just this long fucking rant that's bleeped out. And you see these hand motions that Buster's doing. And then it comes back to Michael and he looks totally disgusted. And he goes, well, I hope it doesn't come to that. So I so badly want that to, I want to know what was said there.
Well, that's something have you seen Parks and Recreation?
Yeah.
You watch, Leslie Knope's mom, Ron Swanson gave her a nickname, and it plays in the same way that the Buster swearing plays, where almost all of it, but the last word is passable. Mm-hmm. And God, it's so funny. And I'm convinced they just saw Arrested Development and thought, let's do something like that in our show.
Yeah.
It's so funny. It's so funny. And then Lindsay and Job enter and they both, God, this is the symmetry of how they sit down is amazing because they both basically plop on the couch the same way at the same time, which is just delightful. Again, the blocking and pacing of that scene.
Yeah, I was going to say the blocking of that scene is really good.
And they start to criticize their mother. And Buster, oh, it's so weird.
Well, it's almost the first thing he says is almost involuntary. Like,
yes,
he says it's like she gets off on withholding.
Yes.
And he stands up and says that, and they all just look at him, and you can tell. And at that moment, Buster's very adult in how he's saying things.
Right.
And then they are like, oh, my God, Buster. And then he like says something else. He's like, the way she points her fingers and talks, and he's like become the center of attention.
Yes.
And then he just goes on this barrage that ends with the words, you horny old slut. But before that, we have no idea what he says.
No. So what do you think, what does this tell us about Buster's character? Because you're right. When he says she gets off on being withholding, and then everyone's congratulating him. Again, he does this thing with his hands and his body where he looks very childlike at that moment. So it's as if he has this moment of adulthood, but then he immediately reverts back to this prepubescent childhood demeanor. What does this tell us about Buster that he has these moments where he dips into this incredibly aggressive language that feels almost like repressed emotions?
It's definitely repressed. I think that I can't imagine what his childhood was like, you know? I mean, we see later that Lucille dressed him up however she wanted and
Mother Boy.
And did whatever she wanted with him. But like, so that's definitely a thing. And Buster, we know, I mean, Buster is an adult in that one moment we see.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, you are an adult. But as soon as he gets a center of attention, because he probably never had it growing up, he has to go back to being a kid. Maybe like as a defense mechanism, I'm not sure.
Because I wonder this phrase arrested development, of course, applies to so many different characters across the show. But for Buster, it's quite literal. He hasn't grown or developed emotionally. He's grown physically. And you mentioned he's perhaps not unlike Lenny from Of Mice and Men. Mm-hmm. He's this relatively large human being who just acts like a child. And there's something funny about it, but there's something quite sad as well, because I wonder.
I agree with that.
Because we've talked about how there's something special and unique about Michael because he's unmoored himself from the trauma of being a Bluth, it seems, or at least he's become a semi-functional human being. But Buster is on the complete end of that binary where he's not even close to being a functional human
being. Right, yeah, yeah.
And it's really, really sad. Mm. But it's hilarious as well.
It is hilarious. It's I guess like, and again, I didn't really notice that moment of adulthood until today. I watched it, you know, because we've been talking pretty deeply about these characters.
Yes.
It's making me think about it a lot differently. And seeing Buster like in that moment, I did feel for him. I was like, this poor guy, man.
I know. Me too. And when George, and we talked about this earlier, when George Sr. says, I didn't really try with him because I was so burnt out on raising all of you. We learn later he didn't really do much raising. It was all manipulation and coercion. I wonder what would Buster look like if George Sr. actually tried. Maybe it would be even worse.
Oh yeah, I mean, who
because
knows,
then he would really? Be like Lindsay and Job, or maybe. And I think this is interesting. Is Buster someone who could have ultimately been like Michael if he was given the time and energy? Because he seems to have a genuinely good, sympathetic heart.
Yes, yeah.
And he wants to care for people in the same way that Michael wants to care for people. So I see someone like Buster, and I think you're Michael if no one cared about you.
Yeah, I think, and at the end of the episode, there is this moment when Michael is talking to Buster, and Lucille kind of confronts him. And you can see in that moment that Michael really loves Buster.
Yeah.
And, like, so badly wishes he could save him from whatever this is. Yeah. But Buster can never, like, get out of the grasp of his mom.
No.
Like, ever.
And that seems to be
And it's
tragedy.
Really sad. Like, that's tragedy, a sad right? moment. Yeah. yeah.
No, it is a sad moment. And it's sad for both of them because Michael wants to save people who can't be saved.
Yeah.
And all Buster wants to do is make incremental changes to an incredibly abusive relationship where now he's not sitting in the back of the car. He gets to sit in the front. And that is such a victory for him. But that's not a victory at all.
Yeah, I mean, I used to love that line, and yeah. I still do. I just deliver.
It's
really,
a funny line.
It's really funny, and he says, I sit in the front seat now, Mom. And he looks at Michael, and Michael gives him this like subtle wink, and I like that a lot. It is like super sad.
Yeah, he's what 34, 35 yeah. years old, and this is the first real victory he's ever had. He gets to sit in the front seat of his mother's car as she drives him around.
And then after that, we get this moment. I'm jumped ahead. I'm sorry, but we're talking about the ending where Lucille strangely loves Michael a lot.
Okay, so I wrote something about this. This episode suggests that Michael is a good father because he has perspective, which his family does not. It's interesting because he seems to find a synthesis between the two positions regarding parenting that both of his parents offer. George Sr. in prison says, let your son go. Lucille at the end says, hold on tight.
Right.
And it seems as though Michael's objective is to find a way to synthesize those two positions, because if he lets go, then what happens to his son? His son probably becomes Job or Lindsay, but if he holds on too tight, his son becomes Buster.
Yeah.
And he doesn't want him to be either of those. Man.
I never looked at the show that way at all. But
yeah.
And I also wonder how sincere George Sr. is in prison, because the whole time he's saying this, like, Buster is literally right there.
Yeah.
And he's saying all these things like I didn't do well with him. And he talks about him in the third person, and Buster is right there, right next to him. And we don't know that until the camera zooms out and Buster starts to yawn. And when Buster yawns is when he grabs Michael's arm.
And doesn't he say something like, we really blew through nap time?
That's later.
Okay.
That's actually in this episode when they're talking to the businessman.
Okay, yeah.
They're Michael's having the lunch. Yeah, that's when Buster says it.
Here I go again.
He keeps yawning.
Here I go again. Lucille's line, look at me getting off. God, I love that line so much. Buster, would you like a candy bar?
No, you can't have it.
Look at me getting off on being withholding. Like, so amazing. Oh, goodness. We haven't talked about Tobias in the play yet.
Oh, we haven't. Yeah.
We need to. And we're only 38 minutes in. So we have plenty of time. So what?
It's awesome. All of it's awesome.
It is. It's so great. It's such a great B plot. What is happening with this play?
The first thing we got to talk about is Tobias' stage role onto the stage.
Which is a callback. Yeah, he does that role so many times. He does that role at Maggie Leiser's house when he rolls over her washing machine, maybe.
He's trying to smoothly get on the stage, and like he does this weird like somersault roll thing, and then he stands up like Willy Wonka, basically.
You're right. No, oh my God, John. Oh, I understand Tobias so much better now. He wants to be Gene Wilder from Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, doesn't he?
I could totally see that.
That's
absolutely.
What he, I mean, his... Oh, my God. because he indulges in that kind of whimsical, magical thinking so much. That's exactly who he wants to be.
I just blew Colin's mind.
You did.
Inadvertently.
You did. I didn't even mean to. Oh, my God. I will never. Oh, I need to go home and watch Willy Wonka now. That's who Tobias wants to be.
And he does it twice.
He does.
In this episode. He also falls in the folding chair when he's directing, and that shit's hilarious. And he's in a camping chair, and he's like leaning forward, and he just fucking face plants, and it's perfect.
And then he says, pick that up.
I didn't realize how much of a physical comedian David Cross is. He's so perfect.
He does a Buster Keaton fall, I think, either later this season or in season two. It's a joke where Lucille spills part of a martini and everyone falls.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he does the one leg of the air Buster Keaton fall. And it's such a great fall.
Oh, my God.
No, you're right, John. He is. Part of what I'm trying to also think about is, okay, who's the best actor on this show? Who does the most with less? Who do I walk away from each episode thinking I could leave it all behind but that? And for the longest time, it was always Will Arnett as Job. But Tobias, because of the work he does physically, I think you're right. I think it's David Cross as Tobias. He's the one I can't leave behind.
Yeah, he's so good.
He is so good.
And, okay, so here's what's happening with the play, if I can
get it right.
He can't be in the play because it's high school, but he gets to direct it. We talked about that earlier.
And it's Much Ado About Nothing.
It's Much Ado About Nothing. And Steve Holt is the main lead. I can't remember the guy's name.
I don't know the actor who plays Steve Holt.
No. The actual name in Much Ado About Nothing.
Oh, so he's Benedict.
Right. And the female maybe lead is Beatrice.
Interestingly enough, I don't think their audition lines are from Much Ado About Nothing. I think they're from As You Like It.
There's a Shakespeare nerd across from me right now.
Yeah, yeah. And then we kiss, right?
So Maybe wants to get in the play, used to kiss Steve Holt.
Right.
George Michael wants to get in the play, used to kiss Maybe.
Right.
Which is also fucked up and weird.
It is. And Steve Holt wants to be in the play, and I think Steve because Holt, he likes theater.
Yeah, he's just Steve Holt. That's what he is. And George Michael gets the stand-in of Steve Holt's character. So and that's like what you're saying, that comedy in threes. They have three auditions. Maybe says, and then we get the kiss, right? And then George Michael says, and then there's a kiss, right?
And I love Michael Cera's reading of those lines because he so clearly doesn't care at all. He just wants to kiss Maybe because he reads those lines in such an uninspired way.
Yeah, he does.
When he's auditioning, it's, oh, God, it's so funny.
And then it shows who got what parts. And Steve Holt sees his name and says, Steve Holt. Maybe sees her name and says, Steve Holt. And then George Michael sees his name and goes, stand in for Steve Holt. And out of nowhere, Steve Holt busts in and goes, Steve Holt.
It's awesome. What do you think Steve Holt was doing? Was he just standing in a court? Did he check the cast list and then just walked over, but then heard his name and turned around?
I think in my brain, Steve Holt's like a weird superhero that is, whenever he hears his name, he just goes to there. And
it's a compulsion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Tobias sees George Michael talking to Steve Holt and thinks, oh, George Michael's gay, maybe quits because Tobias is directing the play.
And that's set up because Michael comes to the school to deliver George Michael's bike.
Right.
And he's talking to Tobias and he says, maybe it's about a girl, because Michael looks over and sees two or three girls standing in a corner. And that's just his immediate assumption. Well, he's doing this because he likes a girl. And again, he's not wrong. Like Lindsay earlier, he's not wrong. But that doesn't mean he's necessarily right. But anyway, and you're right. Tobias then just assumes.
Tobias just sees George Michael and Steve Holt talking and just assumes.
Oh, that's it.
Oh, maybe it's about a boy.
Yeah.
And then puts Steve Holt as Beatrice and Michael as George Michael as Benedict. And it's just.
And he frames it with some not incorrect historical information about how during the Renaissance period, women were not, they weren't allowed to act until well after the Reformation. So all of the female parts would have been played by men or typically young boys.
Yeah.
But the male parts would not have been played by females. So
what's weird is the whole B plot is almost like a Shakespeare play.
Yes.
I just thought about it. It's bizarre.
Yeah, it moves in threes.
So
it's so weird.
And I mean, your Shakespeare play has five acts, but you could easily condense that to three acts or a three act movement.
Yeah.
And there are three movements to that B plot.
Because like Tobias would definitely be like a matchmaker, like muse kind of character in a Shakespeare play.
Yep.
That is blowing my mind right now.
So he's
Mitch Hurwitz, you son of a bitch.
In plays like, so in Much Ado About Nothing, for example. So Much Ado About Nothing is a play about these two characters who have a very antagonistic relationship, and all their friends think, well, what if we could get them to marry one another, and they'll soften one another, and they'll be more likable, and they won't be alone. And the play in many ways circulates around that tension. Will we be able to get them together? But in Much Ado is a weird play because there's this bit in the middle that's very unsavory with Hero and
right.
Claudius. Or Claudio, excuse me. It's really quite awful.
And so if let's just say that the lines that they read are from As You Like It, I mean, As You Like It Again is about a girl that wants to be with a guy who dresses like a guy.
Yes.
So, like, that's a weird plot. That's so bizarre that I'd never thought about that till right now.
Yes.
Damn.
I know.
Wow.
And also when Tobias says he wants to be a Cupid, he does this very dramatic thing. Again, as if he acknowledges a camera is watching him.
Right.
Where he takes his pen and touches his tongue.
And then he keeps touching his tongue.
Because it tastes good.
He keeps eating his pencil.
That's so wonderful.
Oh, shit.
So, okay.
This episode is so deep.
It is. So let me ask you, because this B plot, George Michael doesn't get to kiss Maybe. There's some weird gender role swapping. And Maybe kisses Steve Holt, but we're told she doesn't like it. And this is also a funny joke because she thinks Steve Holt smells like her mother. And we know that because Tobias grabbed the red dress that Lindsay was wearing earlier in the episode.
Yes.
What does George Michael learn from this whole interaction?
If anything? Nothing.
Nothing.
Okay.
I mean, what could he learn?
I don't know. I think we're led to believe because of the way that final bit is framed that George Michael is learning something. Because of the editing.
And
Michael Cera's performance, he seems to have some kind of acknowledgement or recognition.
Yeah, but you and I know that he doesn't learn anything.
I know. But I think the way it's framed and edited, we're led to believe he's learned something.
Maybe.
But in fact, he's learned nothing.
Yeah. And then he goes back and him and his dad reconcile and... And that whole thing is kind of tied up. But yeah, there's so much happening. There's so much parent stuff happening.
There is.
There's so much family issues. And I mean, the show is about family, but this is really about family.
This one is more than most. Because if I were to hazard a guess, it's only after George Michael sees Maybe and Steve Holt kissing that he then wants to go home and reconcile with his father. And I don't know. I wonder, and this is a bit half-baked, if he comes to the recognition that he was being a little childish and immature and that his father was just trying to connect with him. And that's not a bad thing. And it's a good thing to have a parent who wants to connect with you because, my God, he sees children and parents who don't want to connect with one another who want to connect with one another in ways that don't work, like Tobias with Maybe, because I think there's a way you could argue this is not about Tobias trying to connect with his daughter. Tobias hears the word acting and then he moves. So there's something really narcissistic about what he's doing.
Yeah. I mean, Lindsay and Tobias are the most Well, and Job.
Job.
All of them.
All of them.
Except Buster.
Except Buster. Yeah. Yeah. Except Buster. I don't know. I don't know if he learns anything in this particular episode. I think the episode just needed to come to a harmonious conclusion where Michael and George Michael reconcile.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the end of this is very nice. And the moment when Buster and Michael and Lucille are having their three-way confrontation there, the camera, again, only gives us what we need to see. And after Buster leaves with his mom and Michael's kind of disheartened by it, the camera then zooms out and this whole thing's been taking place over a board meeting. And it's great. I mean, it's shot really well.
It is.
But like that is it's kind of like it's Michael's really deflated and he goes home. And when he sees George Michael, he says, "You're here." But he doesn't say it like in a I thought you'd be gone kind of way, but like in a really kind of loving dad way. It's really good.
And George Michael has brought the cornballer out.
Yeah.
Which is nice. I like how the cornballer frames this episode. it's really, really clever because you're right. If you're thinking about framing, especially in a Shakespeare play, most of the comedies are framed in a really coherent way. And there's a lot of mirroring. So in As You Like It begins with people fleeing the city, fleeing civilization because of political instability and occupying the woods or nature, which mm-hmm. is the symbol of instability, which is a symbol of a kind of natural stability or harmony in nature. But the play ends not with them remaining in the woods or remaining in nature, but they must return to civilization.
Yeah.
And there's a similar mirroring happening in this episode as well.
Yeah.
Which I really liked. What did you think of how, because we talked about how it's shot, you're someone who is probably better equipped to talk about some of the technical choices that were made. What did you think of how the episode was shot, edited, framed?
I mean, it's not.
Did you have any thoughts about that?
It's not much different than the other episodes. I mean, the handheld stuff, I like it a lot. And most of the show is shot handheld. And I guess maybe, I don't know why that is. Again, we haven't really figured out what the narrator, who the narrator is, and who the camera is, kind of.
Yeah.
Because that is a thing. But I think it's great. And in this episode a lot, they really focus on the confines of the camera. And I like directors that do that. I like directors that only let you see what they want to show you, because that's all we need to see as a viewer. And us like being surprised with, you know, with Buster being in scenes or with the whole board being there. I mean, I think that's like a really great choice that they made to do that, because that now we feel like everybody in that room's as awkward as we are right now. Like we're all seeing this. I mean, not with Buster. With Buster, that's just a comedic thing.
But, yeah.
But with the boardroom thing, that's more of a, we're in this awkward situation together now, you know.
Kind of. Oh, I think that's a great observation, because this is something that happens in season 4, and we'll get there at some point. But the idea that there's all this happening around the camera that we're not seeing. And then to have that moment where the camera pulls back to reveal there's so much happening that I, whomever I am, director, mm-hmm. am not showing you. It's an important reminder that the camera has a function. And with a lot of multicam sitcoms, it's not doing anything. It's just sitting there. There's no artistry whatsoever to editing and camera placement and camera movement. But this is a show, and you're right, it's doing the handheld thing, which it's so, I'm trying to think of the best way to describe it. It permeates so much of popular culture now.
Yes.
That we might forget just how interesting that would have been 10, 12 years ago to do the handheld thing.
Yeah,
for a sitcom.
Yeah, there's not a lot of, I can't really think of any comedies before this that weren't like, we're on a stage set, there's an audience, there's 3 cameras, that's it.
Well, Malcolm in the Middle didn't have a laugh track.
Malcolm in the Middle, that might be it.
And maybe, well, that 70s show had a laugh track, but it did some interesting things where it would pan around in the basement, which.
But it didn't play with it like this.
No.
Malcolm in the Middle is the best other, Malcolm in the Middle is a great show.
It really is a great show.
It's so fucking good.
I can't wait for our Malcolm in the Middle podcast.
It plays with that as well. Yes. Like the editing in that, but the editing in that makes everything way more grand.
Yes.
It's like this huge scale, and Arrested Development's not ever grand.
No.
It's always, these are the characters I want you to focus on. And I want you to focus on Michael's face right now. I want you to see Buster's weird hands.
Yes.
I want you to see. And it's great. It does that perfectly.
It's beautiful. You're right. Okay, let's talk about the banana stand.
Banana stand, okay.
Banana stand. John, who wins your banana stand award for this week?
I gotta give it to Tobias.
Okay.
I mean, I don't think Buster's crazy. I think Buster's just being Buster, which is a difference. But I think Tobias using his daughter's high school play to be a director, to then force 2 guys to kiss because he thinks they're gay, but then to make his daughter a man and the guy a woman, that's pretty crazy.
Yes. It is really crazy. I don't disagree with you. He's insane in this episode.
Yes, he is. Is that your choice for banana stand?
No, I don't think so. I think it could easily be Tobias. Job doesn't do a lot.
Job doesn't do anything in this episode.
But that's my point. So what does Job do in this episode? Job apparently sneaks into the house with a robe and sleeps unbeknownst to Michael and then is kicked out of the house. He then goes and sleeps in the office somehow, and as a show of perhaps desperation, depression, or discontent, starts feeding toast into a shredder. What's he doing? What is he thinking? And then he comes back to the house fully clothed. Oh, by the way, we didn't talk about how he spent a couple of days with Lucille.
Yeah, I was going to say, we didn't talk about that.
We didn't talk about this. And then just, I don't know, at what, 8 in the morning, starts playing music for some reason. What is Job doing? He's insane.
That has one of the best lines, which is
two of the best lines.
She's not that Mexican, Mom. She's my Mexican. And then he says some other racist line after that.
Hold on. I have it. Hey, if I can't find a horny immigrant by then, I don't deserve to stay here. So Lucille does a...
Which Marta is not that at all.
No, she's not. Lucille does a thing where she smirks and then taps him on the shoulder. And I believe I wrote down, I think the thing that connects Job and Lucille is their shared racism. Like, this is...
You're absolutely
correct. This is how the two of them bond. The two of them bond by being super racist.
Poor Lucille.
I know. So Job gets mine... Because we learn later that Marta's amazing, and she's...
In no way is she a horny immigrant.
No, she's not. And she's successful and...
Super supportive of Joe.
Very supportive. She tries to support his magician
endeavors. And she loves it.
She loves it about him.
She loves everything he does to, like, the most supportive, amazing degree.
Yes.
And Job treats her like trash.
Like garbage. So Job wins my banana stand award because his self-destructive behavior is hilarious.
He's not as crazy weird. As Tobias, I don't think.
I don't disagree with you.
I put Tobias a little bit higher, maybe.
That's fair.
Just a little bit.
Best lines? We've talked about
I've
a lot of them.
I've said most of mine. I think Steve Holt over and over is awesome, and that's a callback that happens a lot. It never gets annoying, which is good. Oh, the Job high five. We didn't talk about that.
Oh, God, I love the high
five. It's awesome when Job goes for the high five and Michael doesn't give it to him.
Does he say up top?
No, he just looks. He says something along the lines of, looks like I'm going to be staying here for a few days. And he puts his hand up.
Okay.
And Michael goes, no, you're not. Or something like that.
Yeah. Right.
The cornholing line, we talked about that. Oh, Tobias saying, I want you to act like you're in love, not two young men playing grab ass in the shower.
I think Tobias has the best line once again, because last episode it was we are just ass to ankles back here.
You're just ass to ankles back here. Yeah, that's
which
that
is a wonderful line.
That's okay. All the Buster stuff that is just bleeped out is awesome. Yeah, I've already said all the things I have.
Okay. I have a couple that I haven't mentioned. Tobias is lovely in the kitchen in the first act when Lindsay corrects him and says, you're not an actor. And he basically swallows the line. He says, lovely. And then goes on when Lucille shouts, what's wrong with Buster? And then he does something crazy. I that was also early in the episode. When Tobias says something, I think this is after he's explaining how women were not allowed to act on the Renaissance stage. And then he says, fancy that.
Tobias is so crazy.
The doctor said there were claw marks on her uterus.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh. She's in the womb for 11 months. Yeah.
Oh, God, when Job's explaining why he's not staying with Lucille and he says it's utterly macabre. That was great. When Maybe says it's going to be a huge disaster, I'll get you tickets. I love her. I love her reading of that line. And then we talked about look at me getting off. Such a great line.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Those are mine.
Oh, and the line that George Sr. says about Buster being soft and doughy. Yes. And that's great.
I think Jeffrey Tambor's comedic strength is his timing, because he never rushes through a bit of dialogue. He takes so much time with those lines, and it's, God, it's so great.
It is so good.
And he gives himself a bit of space to do funny things with his face and his hands. God, I love him so much.
Yeah, I think he has my favorite, like, facial movements and just how he looks at people, like, looking at him when he says stuff. It's just great.
We talked about that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Came out a little soft. God, I just love everything he does with his face. So many wonderful expressions. Callbacks. The Tobias role is something we'll see multiple times. Buster, you can't do that.
And
Buster's doing something outrageous. And of course, Steve Holt, which you've mentioned a callback. I think that's all. I can't think of anything else. Any other callbacks?
No, I don't think so. Yeah.
No. Okay. John, anything else for season one, episode three?
Oh, there is a callback really quickly. Okay. The Job going for a high five, not getting it.
Okay.
Especially when he says, when Job's going through all the ways to make developments better. I know we're at time, but I have to talk about this.
No,
and he says, look out, because you're living in Fuck City. And he like goes off.
This is when he works. This is in season two when he works for Sitwell. You think I'm joking. That's another moment where the joke works because it's in threes.
Oh, no. He says Swing City. Then he says Fuck Mountain. That's what he ends it on.
He says Swing City. Single City, Fuck City, and then later he calls it Fuck Mountain.
And then when he does that, he goes for the high five, and Sitwell's like, "You're fired." Oh God. Okay.
Well, babe, okay. That reminds me. This is a callback. Job walking in to a room and then explaining how he's been kicked out of a place. That happens a lot.
That
happens in that episode. It's like, I'm back.
Oh,
and,
God.
And then he explains, and then it cuts to, okay.
That made me cry.
I can't wait till this. That's my favorite season two story when he works for Sitwell.
It's amazing.
I love when Joe becomes CEO. It's so great.
All right.
Cool. Okay. Well, I think that's it for the Hop Ons podcast. My name is Colin Cox.
I'm John Phelps.
John, great work.
Yeah, man.
Up top.
All right.
Okay. High five. The Hop Ons podcast is a Nice Marmot production with help from the Cluttered Desk podcast and music by Test Dream. All of our contact information is in the show notes. The easiest way to contact us is through Twitter at Hop Ons Podcast and email hoponspod@gmail.com.